This is tape number one, the Apollo 11 crew debriefing. The initial portion of the tape will probably consist of tests of the tape recorder and microphones emanating from the other side of the room. And the initial portion of the debriefing will begin at the top of the outline. First subject will be suiting and ingress.
One, two, three, four, five.
Started running? Okay, she's locked in place then, and I guess we're recording. So, where do you want to begin?
Okay, this is debriefing session number one on Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock, Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin.
Attention to the RRL. We have an indication of a containment fault reported in room 1-122. I say again, we have an indication of a containment fault.
Yeah, I think what Lloyd wanted was for each of us to identify ourselves by voice so that the gal doing the typing will know who's saying what. This is Collins.
And this is Aldrin, 1-2-3-4-5-5-4-3-2-1.
And that other guy is Armstrong. Okay. You want to start with the...
The format you want to use is just to... Why don't you, do you also have a mic out there? Oh, you don't, so it only goes on from this side, huh? Okay, I'll just read off these headings, and then if anybody has a comment on any one, why, we'll bring it up. Otherwise, we'll just keep going. Okay, since... Section
do,
one.
Do you want to play that thing back one time to make sure that the volume and everything is okay before we...
Section one is suiting and ingress. Item one, sensor application. Suiting.
Well, in the area of sensor application, I guess I don't know whether this is the time to bring it up, but there were two things that come to my mind. One of them is that the center lead that I had did dry out in flight. Now maybe that's a flight type comment instead of a suiting one. Okay, in other words, that one did dry out and for an unexplained reason. It was shaved in that area. And the other comment I have is that the one on my right chest must have interfered in some way with the suit, because when it was taken off on the carrier, there was a small laceration on the outside toward the rear of that particular sensor. And I think that's been documented in the medical. Examination.
Anything else on sensors?
Let me interrupt a second. Just open the hook and push the light. And the
well, good. Thank you. Glad to hear it. I've been on that list, but I thought it was probably coming up in November or something like that. 4th of September? Oh, well, great. Thank you. That's a good deal. All right. Sehr gut.
Sunni.
Seemed to be plenty of pad in the time frame. We were, sitting around at least 20 minutes after completely suited up before we had to move out.
But there was a reasonable amount of pad to handle little problems you might run into. Time line on suiting was good. Life support equipment. Transportation out to the pad. No problems in these areas. Elevator. Flight deck. Personal comfort. Now, in previous flights, they had some troubles with temperatures.
That comes later. That's down here under item 10.
Oh, okay.
The only personal comfort problem I had was my suit fit too tight through the crotch area where I got that UCD on there. And during CDDT, I was really very, very uncomfortable for a couple hours there with that UCD pushing into my crotch area. And this goes back to getting that first suit fit at the factory. That the ILC is very concerned about mobility inside a pressurized suit and all that stuff. And on my suit, at least, they went a little bit overboard in cutting that thing on the tight side. And when I went up there for a suit fit, I didn't really go through everything that I should have gone through. In terms of, I didn't really put the UCD on. You know what I mean? They've got a house UCD up there, and you sort of slap that in inside the suit, and then you get a fit check. But where only time it hurt me was when I actually had the UCD on, where it was being securely held, and when I was strapped into the couch, when my legs were up, and I was strapped in there, and that really hurt. The only thing I could suggest to anybody else is when they go to the factory, take with them their own UCD and put the damn thing on during that fit check and go through some kind of an imitation of the launch position. You know, I think they have a little apparatus up there where they can lift your legs up, but get the correct leg-to-body angle that you have in that couch at the launch position. And with the UCD, your own UCD actually on, see whether that's going to be comfortable or not, because it wasn't... I fiddled and diddled with it between CDDT and launch. It was still fairly uncomfortable for launch, but for CDDT, that damn thing almost did me in there. And I guess the only point to be gained here is don't let them cut the suit too tight and try to get a good fit check at the factory.
Pre-ingress preparation. This has to do with the time we spent in the white room prior to entry, I guess.
Well, from the center couch position, it's a very pleasant time period because I sit in the elevator and walk around up there in the flight deck and contemplate just about everything, including the outside world. And during CDDT, it was a very pleasurable experience looking out over the whole beach. All I can say other than that's one of the things that has to take place. Is he on the line now?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have anything on that. It was all fine.
Okay. Ingress. No problems with ingress. PGA connections and suit circuit check. I guess the appropriate to remark here that while we were completing the strap-down procedures and the number two hand controller, rotation hand controller, was raised to the launch position, it had somehow managed to attach itself to the
shock attenuator strap.
Shock attenuator release on the
lower left
strut, and released that after a good bit of work and coordination between Mike and Fred, the BCMP, that was relocked. That's nothing, no new procedure there. It just requires care in properly installing those hand rests to avoid recurrence of that problem. Probably brings out the point, too, that's well for the BCMP. Repeat, it would be well for the BCMP to assure himself that he knew how to relock those strut releases, any one of the available strut releases that might come disengaged in this time period. Any other comments on connections and the suit circuit check?
No, I think just the crew ought to know about those strut softeners, too, just in case one of them gets pulled loose inadvertently in flight. They ought to know how to reset them. That ought to be one little item added to their list of things to learn.
Well, this is probably as good a place as any to mention it, but I still don't feel that we really need life preservers on for launch. They, I think, interfere with what little mobility you have, and they would serve to prevent any rapid egress if it was needed, or at least to interfere with that. And it appeared to me that if in any abort condition you did need to make use of the life preservers, that it would be a fairly simple thing to get them out of the little pouches that are in the L-shaped bag.
Okay, comfort and couch, pressure points, temperature, and humidity. Any comments?
Pressure points I've already talked about.
Temperature was good in our spacecraft in both CDDT and launch, and didn't suffer any of the abnormally low temperature conditions that had been reported on some previous flights.
And the reason was that we were flowing glycol through the secondary loop. I believe that was the first time they tried doing that. They used to put
the circuit heat exchanger.
Yeah, the secondary glycol loop was had its pump on, and it was flowing through the suit circuit heat exchanger. And the procedure that they described, I don't know what Apollo 10 did, but I remember Apollo 9 described this deal of going bypass on the heat exchanger for 15 seconds and all that. We didn't have to mess with that at all. I guess to make a long story short, our procedure worked very well, and I don't know who thought it up to use the secondary loop, but it made the system very comfortable, and I recommend that they just continue to do it the way we did it.
Cabin closeout. Vibration or noise sensations pre-launch?
No, they called out everything. Every time we were going to feel something, they were very good about calling it out.
Okay, this is
We did observe some booster valving. Again, they'd call them out, and it was quite obvious when there was certain valving taking place.
Hey, Lloyd.
That is checks and countdown. First, FECS Pyro. Com verification. As best I recall, our pre-launch com checks were all reasonably good.
Yeah, you got that on, Emily?
It's on now. Say it again.
Our pre-launch com checks were all reasonably good. Our voice verifications with Houston, with STC, and and others was were very satisfactory.
Okay, you're running again.
I still think it's unfortunate that because of the location of that center panel that we do have to split the comm and take the center couch off of PADCOM. I can't say that we really suffered much on account of it. It would be nice if there were some way to make that switch position change, or figure out some way to loosen the belt and get back up there and readjust the comm, or change positions in some way.
Okay, stable member azimuth check. GNC verification. FDAI power. GDC align was good. EDS. SMRCS firing.
No, we didn't do that.
What's that mean?
Which wasn't performed. Delta V check.
We didn't do that.
Was not
That's
performed.
EMS? Yeah, we didn't do that.
Ground communications and countdown. Again, all the communications was excellent throughout the pre-launch phase. Launch prep. Tape recorder.
It was fine.
Systems preparation.
Yeah, they were fine.
Crew comfort. No problems with controls and displays that I can recall.
They had that attenuation strut positioned very nicely so that I could see the altimeter. You know, in the simulator, it's very difficult for the center couch to see anything in the altimeter, but they had rotated this handle on the X strut on the left of my seat so that I could see just about the entire altimeter, which is good. I think that ought to be done as standard procedure.
Pre-lift off sounds in the launch vehicle.
Well, again, they called all those out. I thought they did an excellent job of warning us of what to expect. Not that it really makes a hell of a lot of difference. You're going to sit there anyway, but it's darn nice to know.
Well, there wasn't much of a jolt when that swing arm moved out and came back in again.
No, that was reasonably smooth, and I didn't really note any vehicle sway prior to ignition. Powered flight, section 3. S1C ignition.
Really wasn't much of a cue at all that I could recall. Of course, we're going to get to it pretty quick here about the vibration when hold-on arms were released, but I can't remember before actually T-0 feeling much of anything. How about the rest of you?
No.
Wasn't any sound
particularly.
It was very quiet, I thought. It was very quiet, and you could feel that the engines were starting up. I mean, there was a low amplitude
vibration.
But okay, back to work. The tape is running. Powered flight. S1C ignition.
Calm audibility ignition.
Good. I thought.
Could hear just fine. Calm was good at ignition and subsequent for that matter. Noise vibration intensity prior to release.
That was moderate, I thought.
Moderate vibration, low noise.
Low noise, moderate vibration. I'd say light to moderate vibration. I didn't really notice much vibration until we released.
Not until the release is when I would say it started.
Shock, I don't think there was any shock. I'm not sure what they mean by that. Shock, I don't understand. Cruise sensation prior to release. I think cruise sensation prior to release was just about what you'd expect from a Titan or from previous crew briefings on the Saturn V. It was quite mild prior to release, I thought.
Now, release itself, I think we have a little bit of difference there. I felt that I could detect release, and I think your comments were that perhaps you weren't quite so sure just at what the moment of release was.
Well,
attention NDLRL. Concerning the reported containment.
Okay, well, tape's running. Say again, Buzz, you're talking about.
Well, I can't recall any sudden change that occurred at that point. It seems to me that there was a gradual sensation of upward movement, and then the vibration, which it's more of an oscillation, I think, than a vibration, and it certainly wasn't just longitudinal. There was a fair amount of lateral, and both in the Y direction and the Z direction. I don't know what frequency I'd call it, a couple of cycles a second motion back and forth, certainly not completely expected. It was a little surprising to me, and this started rather suddenly right at
abruptly liftoff. That's what I thought. I could not detect liftoff by the conventional means of sensing a transverse acceleration. I could not determine that. But to me, the moment of liftoff was very apparent because this vehicle, which had been rigidly held, was now suddenly released, and we were getting all manner of oscillations, X, Y, and Z, as near as I could figure. And all of a sudden, this thing obviously had changed character from a static to a dynamic situation, and that was what I would call the incident of liftoff.
The noise vibration intensity at liftoff. It was my impression that that combination was rather severe until approximately the time of tower clear, at which time there was a significant decrease.
It decreased considerably.
But would you say noise? I wouldn't say. I would say vibration. I would agree with you, but noise, I would not agree with you. I thought the noise level was much less than I had expected. The vibration was more.
How about a rumbling that's physically felt as much as heard?
You don't hear it in your ears. You feel it in your whole body.
That's right.
Now, whether that's noise or whether that's vibration, I don't know.
Okay. I would agree that the noise is however, at a low level, but it was discernible.
Well, in terms of interference with communications, though, I think you'd have to say it was very low-level noise.
That's true. And we commented
on high-level vibration.
But subjectively, the first 10, 12 seconds till tower clear took longer than I would have thought it would have.
I would have felt...
It was a long 15 seconds.
10, 12 seconds were going to, you know, be over just like that, as they are in many simulations. But it seemed that...
It was a long, long time before anybody said tower clear.
They were right on time.
Yeah.
I was looking at the vent time.
Yeah. What was it, 14 seconds, something like that, to tower clear?
12.
12 to tower clear?
And that, their comm came through quite clear.
Well, that was a long 12 seconds. And I was very glad to hear tower clear.
Instrument observation was no problem during this time period. All the instruments are equally readable to simulation. As a matter of fact, they're somewhat better because the lighting in the cockpit is much better than it is in the simulator.
But we all agree that there was a decrease in the, whatever it is, this vibration, oscillation, rumbling, that could possibly be attributed to reflections maybe off the tower.
Well, I think it's just reflections off the ground.
Ground effect.
Okay, well, it could be tower.
And it goes away very distinctly about the tower clear time, within a couple of seconds of that.
So what causes it, we don't really know, but it could be the vehicle length away from the ground, characteristic length, whatever you call that.
On LV lights, roll program, pitch program, and roll complete were on time, as were the rate changes. Now, I'd comment that my impression in the seat throughout this phase, as well as the subsequent first stage flight, was that of going over a rough railroad track in a train, with the vibrations occurring in all three axes.
Yep.
Yeah, it was a rougher ride than I expected right at the beginning. That's all I can say.
There were sharp bumps
in each
of the three axes periodically.
The gain of the system was pretty high, I felt.
Cabin pressure.
The valves worked as advertised. It started decreasing right at schedule.
And you can hear those valves relieving, I think, from all three crew stations.
Matter of fact, when they were relieving, as I recall, you couldn't hear too much else. It was...
I didn't think they were that bad.
I thought they were. Yeah,
I could hear calm over the top of it.
Didn't cut out calm.
Mm-hmm.
Mach 1 and Max-Q noise levels. Well, I think I was surprised at how little these were apparent to me, and particularly Alpha.
Yeah.
Alpha never came off zero throughout the launch, and I really wondered if it were operable. Control response, no observation of control response. It was smooth as glass going through there. EDS, no problems. Outboard engine gimbling, not really noted. Commented on the noise level variation. Pogo oscillations are longitudinal oscillations. Just say that again, that I felt that there were oscillations of some sort periodically, bumps in all three axes, including longitudinal, although probably the longitudinal was the least observable of the three. Inboard cutoff, vehicle attitude, outboard cutoff.
Well, we were anticipating that, and again, it wasn't just a single motion, as I recall. There were several little jolts to your to the relaxing of the 4Gs or whatever it is. At least that's how I recall it.
I felt like we were well briefed on that, though. I mean, yeah. There really weren't any surprises.
Vehicle attitudes, sounds and sensations during staging. Skirt set. As I recall, that could be heard or felt as well as just, in other words, there was a observable characteristic in addition to just the light going out at the time. And I can't remember if it was just a bump or a noise, but
there was
we can tell something happened in addition to the fact
sensation.
That the light was out.
Which would give you a clue if the lights were not working that something had happened at that point.
S2 engine ignition was smooth.
Now, how about the stuff that went scooting forward?
At staging, it was just like staging on the Titan. It seemed to me at staging the whole windows lit up with yellow. But you're through it about a second later. It's just almost a flash of light.
Well, let's see. At S1C.
That was stage. I didn't. That's right. I had the boost protective cover on.
I didn't see much either because we were kind of tossed forward and I couldn't look out the hatch. You're the only one that had a window really at that point. I don't remember
just
anyone saying too much about that. Of course, we did. We'll get to that a little later on the S2.
S2 stages.
Okay. Pogo oscillations during S2 boost. I didn't note any.
It was smooth. Smooth as glass.
S2 was the smoothest ride I've ever seen.
Yeah, it really was. It was beautiful. Beautiful.
Guidance initiate was as expected.
See, how about the tower?
Tower went as advertised.
I know, but where is that in here?
Here it's 33, item 33.
A little farther.
Okay.
No cue ball transients noted at S2 ignition. I may not have been looking at it.
S2 plume, what do they mean by that?
I don't know. Scale change.
Looked pretty from the ground, I guess.
Was not utilized. No unusual noises or vibrations at this point in the flight. It was all smooth. PM ratio shift was observable and you could feel the G decrease. Tower jettison. Could watch it go, but no question about it. Guidance initiate was about as expected. S2, S4B staging and engine cutoff was.
Back then in the car, anybody notice any exhaust at all from the coming back on the windows when the BPC went? Seemed to be pretty clear separation.
I didn't note any, but I wasn't looking carefully at the wind at that point.
No, I wasn't. I didn't notice any.
Okay.
And those windows were clear. They didn't have any deposits on them, 2 and 4.
The S2, S4B staging sequence is a long, slow one. I'm sure it was about equal to the simulated values we were used to, but it seemed like a long time in flight to get the S-4B ignited. S-4B guidance was as expected, and S-4B plume, I'm not sure what that means.
It's not on the list here. Anything to comment about the Gimbal motors coming on? 6 minutes?
The motors were put on at 6 minutes. But all came on.
Confirming those with the...
Well, you can confirm them with the fuel cell flows. They're not, you know, it's not something that really reaches out and grabs you, but if you watch those meters carefully, you could definitely say that all four Gimbal motors came on.
Yeah, of course, I was looking at those sort of things later, but I found, after observing them several times, that right at the time of coming on, you look at the current and you see a fairly small but observable change in the fuel cell current, and then just about a half a second later, you begin to see the rise and flow. So you can catch both of them if you look at current first and then the hydrogen and oxygen flow.
I just looked at hydrogen and oxygen flow, just those indications alone. And as I say, you have to be watching closely, but if you are, you can definitely say that all four of them came on.
Okay. Amps. That was particularly noted during powered flight. No pogo oscillations.
Well, it was a rougher ride to the S-4B than the S-2.
No doubt about that.
Yeah, none you'd call a pogo, but it just wasn't as smooth.
It was a little rattly all the time.
It was a lot smoother than Stafford described his ride. I think we had a lot different S-4B than he had.
See, this doesn't say anything in here about the PU shift in the S-2 at 8 minutes.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did.
Okay.
And that was very noticeable.
That was quite a bit.
Yeah.
About as much as one engine going out.
Yeah. It's probably about right.
About the same change in thrust.
Okay. Separation lights as advertised. Sounds and vibrations we've almost commented on. Communications with the ground for the go-no-goes was without a problem. There was a short time period in there when we didn't hear anything, and I think we gave them a call just to make sure that we still had comm.
Now, following the trajectory throughout boost was quite easy with the card that we had, and I found that, gee, we were within 20, 30 feet per second VI, and within, oh, it seemed to me, 4 or 5 feet per second most of the time, H dot. I guess the altitude is a little lower, wasn't it? That's all.
You continued comment that it was nearly right on.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we might note that we did elect to have this trajectory card over the part of the disky which did cover up some of the status lights. The right-hand column of status lights were covered up, however, the ones in the LEB were observable in case any of those came on.
Engine cutoff was smooth, and we were standing by to do a manual cutoff with the LB stage switch should cutoff not Controls and displays were as expected. Crew comfort, pressure points, temperature, no problems. G-force effect, relatively smooth. Restraints, no problems. Mobility of arms and speaking, no problems.
We didn't seem to elbow each other quite as much as we had in some simulator runs. The suits are big and the elbows kind of stick out, but I didn't notice any interfering with any of our activities.
The only interference I noted was Neil's suit pocket interfered with the abort handle. He was worried about that, and I was worried about that.
Yeah.
We're all worried about that.
Contingency sample pocket, the place that was strapped on the leg, was riding right against the abort handle. So we adjusted that to the as far to the interior of the thigh as we possibly could to minimize the interference, but we still were continually concerned with the fact that we might inadvertently press that thing against the top of the abort handle.
Okay, before we...
We want to note any numbers. I had written down the apogee 103.9, perigee 102.1.
They tell me they've got better sources.
I'm sure they've got all that. I'm just wondering why in our checklist we're not able to write down the CSM weight and gimbal motor numbers. We certainly ought to know what those are before flight and just confirm that those numbers have been set in.
Yeah, I don't know why you fool them at all. Because they come up to you on the first pad prior to...
Yeah, I know, but everybody in the world knows what they are, and they ought to be in the checklist, it seemed to me.
And I don't even know where they list them there at that particular page. Well, the only other thing I had on the launch phase was there was some peculiarity in the servicing of the oxygen quantity, apparently. Oxygen tank number one had 90% on my gauge, and oxygen tank number two had 95% with a 5% differential, and they kept talking about some mission rule which allowed a maximum of 4% differential. And all this was a little confusing to me. It sounded as if we got shortchanged out of oxygen tank number one, but I'm not sure if that's true, and you know, it even occurred to me there might have been a slight leak in tank number one, but I'm sure that they wouldn't have launched this. But a few words on that subject would have been nice. I think, I guess, as a general rule, if the loadings are not nominal, it'd be nice to let the crew know that they're a little off nominal. Because it sounded like we launched in violation of a launch mission rule.
Differential between oxygen tank.
Yes, it was 5%, and it sounded like the mission rule was 4% max. And I was perfectly happy to launch with that if that were the only problem. And I didn't want to bring it up on the loop, you know, and make a federal case out of it, but on the other hand, it would have been nice to know.
Any other comments on launch phase? It only took us an hour and 15 minutes to get through a perfectly normal launch with no problems.
Yeah, we started late.
Okay, section four, Earth orbit and systems checkout. And the first thing is insertion parameters, and let's just comment on what we had. Appeared as though the platform was in reasonably good shape, and its values compared favorably with the Misfin Femurus. Now, this insertion checklist, abnormalities during the insertion checklist, everything went smooth.
Yeah, the insertion checklist is fine as far as I'm concerned. Later on, right after the insertion checklist, the items in the checklist on page L2-8 and L2-9 need some work in getting them in the proper sequence for the...
Yeah, it's pretty hard to follow through and have all those things happen according to the time schedule that's on there, especially when you, you go down to the LEB and get the helmet...
The guy who goes down to the LEB, if he goes through it sequentially as written in this thing, is sort of jumping from one place to another back and forth. And some improvement could be made on the order in which those are in. Now, I sort of got lazy and decided not to fight the checklist world, and I just had my own order in which I was going to do them, regardless of the order that they were printed up. But to really be precise about it, you ought to... The follow-on crews ought to look at this little section and get things rearranged to their liking and for a minimum amount of moving around.
Yeah, well, for example, at step 7 on 2-9, the 20 minutes, the ECS post-insertion configuration, we had been doing other things at that time, and I don't believe we were in position to... be doing that until something like well after we passed Canaries. It was approaching 30 minutes, it seemed to me, yet we had done several other things ahead of that point. Each person is sort of operating on their own. We know what we're going about in the various systems checks, and it doesn't fit into the good timeline.
Right, just as a small example here, page L2-8, item 4, emergency cabin pressure valve to both. That check is made prior to anybody going into the LEB. That's impossible to do. Obviously, you got to be down the LEB to see it. Yet, it's listed prior to the time a CMP goes to the LEB for the main regulator check. Just little things like that. The sequence here is crazy. And as I say, I was lazy and didn't get it straightened out in the checklist world. I just went through it in my own fashion. But to be precise about it, follow-on crews should go through this one time and rewrite this in a more efficient fashion.
Okay. Initiation of time base 6, I think we'll postpone that. Mounting ordeal. We used system where the CMP was already in the LEB and under the couches released the latch on the ordeal and let it float up to the CDR who was still strapped down in the couch and installed that with no problem.
There again, that probably should be a checklist item. If people want the CMP to do that as we did it, well then it probably ought to be written in his list of things to do.
That worked well for us, I think.
Mm-hmm. Worked fine, eh?
Optics cover jettison.
The only thing I just say as a general rule is it goes back to this thing about becoming ill, and that is if you're really worried about anybody becoming ill, the guy you're going to worry about is the one who's rattling around down in the LEB, and in our flight that was me, and it was also the one who'd be doing the transposition and docking, so I was trying to move around with minimum head movements and go minimum, you know, distances traveled and so forth. On the other hand, if you're convinced you're not going to be sick, well, then all those things go away. It's sort of a nebulous area. I don't know what you do about it.
Well, it's something you can't afford to get ahead of yourself and be moving around too fast if there's any question at all. And I think we all played it very cautiously until each of us in our own particular way realized that it was just no problem.
Yep.
And that we had adapted to it, we could go about any kind of movement that we wanted without any particular concern. But the stakes are pretty high, and you can't afford to let these things get the best of you, because then it's just downhill from there.
Okay, optics covered jettison. I heard a little noise, but I saw no debris, and I could not verify that they had jettisoned. I looked through both instruments, and I couldn't see that they had jettisoned.
Maybe that one never did go up the telescope.
That telescope was terrible. Okay. SCS attitude reference comparison.
It went well, no problems. And RCS checks. I don't know that it will say later, but let's cover it now. We did hot fire checks on the service module RCS prior to TLI. And the intent here was to assure ourselves that we did in fact have a operable control system and that our hand controllers could in fact talk to something before committing ourselves to a lunar trajectory. We did that in minimum impulse over the states, and it was extremely difficult to hear the thrusters firing, and it was impossible to read an effect on any indicator in the cockpit.
This is helmet and gloves on.
Helmet and gloves on. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Helmet and gloves
mm-hmm.
on. So we were pleased when the ground said they could in fact see the thrusters firing, and we did have to repeat one axis, as I remember, if they didn't see.
I don't recall why it was we had the helmets off. I mean, on at that point. Did we take them off?
We took them off and we put them back on.
At the time of the
The thruster firing, we had them back on, and that was when we couldn't hear the
thruster. Yeah, well, probably should have scheduled that. That was done over the states, so the states mm-hmm. could pick up the firing.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying is it'd be good to schedule that with at least one guy with the helmet off
right.
so he could hear it.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the other hand, though, if you schedule it over the states and the ground verifies, then you don't much care.
I was satisfied that we did, mm-hmm. in fact, prove the point that we wanted to prove. Co-ass installation, I don't recall any points there. Unstowage, camera preparation. We had a TV camera preparation also in this time period. Comments there?
Well, again, this camera preparation probably should be written into the checklist on page L2-9. In a bit more detail than it is.
Well, it's on 213 in detail, but you want it sooner?
Well, this is when you're unstowing it, see? Because really all it says is cameras, and that really means the 16 plus the 70 and the various lenses, and put the cameras apart and hand them up to you, and then you get the bracket from Neil, and it's really sort of an assembly process there. And this is sort of dealer's choice, but I suggest that that following crews give some thought right on page 2-9 to deciding what cameras they want to unstow and what they want to do with them and how they're going to do it. Otherwise, they're going to have another trip later back down to the LEB, which really isn't necessary.
Okay, docking probe.
I don't know what they mean by
extension.
That. The extended, all right, I guess that's... Yeah.
Put the switch back and retract.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Work normal.
Just trying to, I think they're just attempting to recall here anything that might have gone abnormally. And
No, there were no funnies in that docking probe.
Communications were more or less in and out in Earth orbit. Sometimes they were quite good. S-band through the various stations. Other times they were only medium. Earth orbit operations in general. Any comments on the Earth orbit operations system?
No, I think in general that's a very nice timeline. We've hammered away at it now enough to where I think we're We're only checking those things that really should be checked, and there's plenty of time available to check them in a leisurely fashion. I think that's a nice timeline.
How about the alignment on the Saturn?
The platform alignment?
Yeah, Z torque angle of plus 0.22 we got from the ground, and the alignment gave us 0.15.
Well, I don't know what to say about that. I think that's probably within normal tolerance. The alignment at orb rate is no problem, as other flights have reported.
Okay, EMS delta V, no problems. Scale change, systems, engine alignments. Got a go for TLI. And then...
Glad to get it.
Well, I think it's worthy to note that we did intend to have the TV camera out, and it did not seem to crowd the timeline, our trying to get those pictures coming up on the West Coast. We still seem to me to have a very comfortable, leisurely approach to TLI.
That's right. And of course, that's what we said. We weren't going to dick with the television if we were rushed in any way or behind the timeline. Did they get any useful signal out of that? Did anybody ever see anything?
Was a good drift test. That has to do with your alignment, I guess, and also with the GDC drift, which was acceptable. Crew readiness and comfort. I think we were ready for TLI, unrushed, and no problems there. Okay, subjective reaction to weightlessness. Fullness in the head, perhaps a little bit.
I didn't notice that there, quite, as,
wasn't,
quite as soon as, coming on as in Gemini.
Yeah, I didn't feel it was as marked and as I had remembered it earlier.
It's so slight that if you have anything else in your mind, you just flat ignore it. I mean, it's not any big effect.
Well, there's the feeling that your face tends to lift up a little bit.
There it does. Your eyes look
puffy.
Different.
Your eyes puffy look different. Puffy looking and a little puffy feeling, and you have this.
But that's just a mechanical thing. You know, if you take that weight away, you look like Chinaman.
Okay. A head sensation of head down position. I guess I had that sensation, expected it, and thought it ought to be there since we were head down.
Since we were head down.
Vertigo. Anybody have problems with vertigo? Visual disturbances. Spatial disorientation. Problems there?
No.
Nausea? None?
No. No, I think we were spring-loaded to the concerned position, and as far as I was concerned, there wasn't anything to really be alarmed about in the least. I do think the fact that you've been through it before makes a good bit of difference. There was a good bit made of this sort of thing before the flight, and
I think for someone who had not flown before, he would have been a little bit overly concerned.
Yeah, we were probably all a little bit overly apprehensive about this area since there have been so many comments on it in recent flights, and fortunately we just didn't run into any problems. Section 5, TLI. TLI burn monitor procedure. The procedure went very well, except...
You had some yaw off, huh?
No, the yaw was perfectly on, but the pitch showed approximately a 1.5 degree bias from the value that we would have expected. That is to say, with the ordeal set in a Lunar 200 configuration, and being at the proper point, on the minute, each minute prior to ignition, the pitch attitude was indicating about 1.5 degrees higher, that is 1.5 degrees into the right, or plus 1.5 degrees from zero, while we expected approximately zero. So our, I think it'd be wise to look at that carefully with our booster training guys, DCPS guys, with respect to the adequacy of that procedure, and see where that little bit of difference occurs. Other than that, the TLI monitoring went that just as expected it was.
But that was an instrument that was used to make changes. I mean, if we were in control, the closing of the loop was really the observation of HDOT, which was surprisingly close.
Right.
At each 30-second period, we froze the disky and looked at HDOT, and it was just amazingly close, in the order of 5, 10, 15 feet per second. Of course, they get to be some pretty good HDOTs, 4 minutes and 30 seconds, about 2,200 HDOT. And I don't think it was off by more than 10 feet per second at that point. Just so much closer than we've seen in any simulations. Just right in the groove.
Had we flown a manual TLI then, though, we would have probably been a little bit off in pitch, and then
I think we would have
seen that our HDOT was beginning to get out of bounds, and we'd made a correction, but we should understand that a little better. S4B performance and engine cutoff was outstanding.
But the time of the burn.
That's right. The burn time was not quite.
Yeah, it was a little.
Quite the book value there. Did we write that down in the checklist? Burn time? Give them a burn status report. We must have on the burn status report. I'm sure that's.
As I recall, it was a little longer than normal. I don't know exactly the seconds.
Now, as I remember, it was like a couple seconds off in burn time, but I just don't recall now. That difference was. But other than that, it went very well. Okay, unstow and preparation of cameras. Any problems there? Well, I don't think.
Let me just note some numbers here that were recorded at freezing the disky after cutoff, and you're bound to miss that by a couple of seconds. The expected VI was 35575. I recorded 35579. The HDOT expected was 4285, and I had 4321. And of course, HDOT was building fairly rapidly, and that's about not quite a mile a second. So the expected altitude 174, and we read 176. EMS was 3.3 plus.
Yeah, we knew when that EMS showed only 3 foot per second off in a 10,000 foot per second burn, it was going to be pretty good too.
Wasn't quite as good as Tom's. 0-0, is that what he had?
He had a real good one. Maybe he forgot to turn it on. Okay. Yes? We better.
The S4B maneuver to separation attitude. Comments on that?
No, it was right on schedule and no comment.
Pre-separation configuration. Problems there?
Nope.
Go, no go for pyro arm. Waste venting.
Well, how about that IO2 flow anomaly? That I guess the ground picked up more than our picking it up or observing it.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Well, why don't we hold that until after DLI stuff?
Not too much we can say about it. You really don't understand it. A little lower, maybe.
S4B control system performance. Tank pressures were good. EDS operation. A long time. Pyro operation, no problems. Okay, separation from slaw. Comments there, Mike?
Well, the only comment on separation from slaw is a general comment about the EMS during the separation and the turnaround and the docking, and that is the EMS numbers got all confused, and I'm not sure when, but the EMS got jolted and did not record some acceleration that it should have, or it recorded some that it should not have. I don't know which is the case, but in my procedures, I use the EMS as an indicator after turnaround as to how much delta V to apply thrusting back toward the booster, and when I got to that stage of the game, the EMS numbers made no sense at all. They were like a foot and a half per second in error. And at docking, that situation continued. The number I jotted down at docking on the EMS was 99.1. And there's no way that that the EMS could read 99.1 in docking. Now, as best I can recall, I thrusted away from the booster until that EMS delta V counter read 100.8, just like the procedure said. And then I thrusted minus X until the delta V counter read minus 100.5, although I was a tenth off. I don't recall. I think I thrusted plus X until I read minus 100.6. So the point at which the EMS was in error was after that, and that's what I don't understand. Because when I completed the turnaround maneuver, the EMS should have read minus 101.1. It didn't. It read down in the 90s somewhere, and at docking itself, when it should have read 101 point something or other, it read 99.1. So there is a funny there in EMS. That's the only comment I have about that.
Okay. High gain antenna activation. Buzz? Mm-hmm.
remember that took us quite a while.
You didn't do that until later.
Yeah, we really didn't get that done until after that.
You want to talk about that now? We want to come to that later.
Well, we just wait.
The checklist didn't talk about it.
Well, we just wait till a little later on that. How about the station keeping and then the transposition and all that?
Well, transposition and docking in general, I think this business of, it worked in flight just as it worked a couple of times during the simulator, and that is, I went manual attitude pitch to Excel command, and I started to pitch up. And after 10 or 20 degrees of pitch up, and when it was definitely established that the needle, the attitude error needle and pitch was full scale high, indicating that the DAP wished to continue the maneuver in the same direction in which I had started it, then I went proceed and manual attitude pitch to rate command, at which time, just as in the simulator, the DAP rolled itself out. It ceased its pitch rate. And I don't understand that. Now, at the time, Buzz said that I had forgotten one proceed there. I believe that's what you said. Or I needed one more proceed. But best I can recall, I went through this procedure, and Neil, maybe you got something to add. You were right there watching, but best I can recall, I went through this turnaround procedure exactly as the checklist was written, and in the simulator, sometimes it worked like magic, and other times it wouldn't. And in flight, it worked just exactly like a bad simulator day. Now, I don't know, somebody ought to go through this deeply, MIT or some GNC people, and see what, if anything, is wrong with this procedure. What I would do right now, if I were going to fly this flight over again, is I would say this, and you may disagree, but I would say it doesn't matter whether you pitch up or you pitch down. You ought to just put those noun 22 values in there, hit proceed twice, and let that thing turn itself around, because you're going to get around within a few, within 30, 45 seconds anyway, and it's such a neat, simple, clean, easy procedure to do it that way. And the way we've got it designed to make sure that we go pitch up instead of pitch down is sort of mixing apples and oranges. It's letting the DAP do it, but then you take control away from the DAP for a little while, and then you give it back to the DAP, and for reasons unknown to me, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work.
I would agree that the hybrid procedure is not the best. I wouldn't agree that the auto procedure is the best. I'd say the manual procedure is probably the best, mm-hmm. in my preference.
Well, this is something that I'm sure Apollo 12 and other flights will want to massage. As I say, I'm firmly convinced that the way to save gas on that is to let the DAP do it and to do a totally automatic DAP maneuver. The price you pay for that is that you never know whether it's going to pitch up or whether it's going to pitch down. Now, to me, that fact is not important. But again, this is a kind of a crew preference item, and there's many different ways to approach it. And all I would say is that in an effort to save gas and to assure that we always pitched up, I ended up wasting some gas.
Okay.
Transposition, that's what we've talked about. Stabilization and alignment at 50 feet. My procedure was worked out where if I went through it ideally, I'd be 66 feet away from the booster at turnaround. And due to these delays, due to the fact that the DAP kept trying to stop the turnaround rate, I would say that we were 100 feet away from the booster when I finally turned around. And this costs extra gas in getting back to it. I think enough said about that. I don't know how much extra gas. They said 18 pounds, I think, or 12 pounds over, but I don't know how much they allocated. I don't know what the nominal was. I think it was a pretty healthy number, 60 or 70 pounds. So that whole maneuver probably cost 80 pounds. And in the simulator, doing it completely automated, I can do it for 30, 35 pounds. So the difference between 30, 35 and probably 80 was just waste gas. The docking itself, as in the simulator, was very easy. I did have a slight roll misalignment. I knew I had a slight roll misalignment, but it seemed everything else was right exactly lined up, so rather than diddle with it and make a last minute correction, I just went ahead and accepted it, and it turned out later to be 2.0 degrees in the tunnel. Photography during transposition and docking, I don't know, Buzz, that's yours.
Well, we used the 16 millimeter camera about the settings that were listed in the checklist, and I think we'll just have to look at how the film turned out before we can say too much more about that. I did use a fair amount of film, and I think the pictures ought to come out reasonably well.
Okay, docking alignment target?
Okay, let's see. System handling characteristics were absolutely normal as per the simulator. I docked in CMC auto, narrow dead band, and the 2 degree per second rate, and went to CMC free at contact. Docking alignment was fine. Adequacy of sunlight, it was more than adequate. There was plenty of sunlight. The CSM docking lights were not required. Let's see, there was one, somewhere in here there was a comment, I think, about the COAS reticle. Its brightness, even with that filter removed, now the modification that's been made to the COAS, it was still quite dim at points during the docking, but it is discernible if you really look closely. At the very end, when you need it, it's more visible than it is 20 or 30 feet out. So I would say that the COAS is marginal but satisfactory. Cabin purge and LEM CSM pressure equalization. I believe all that went just about exactly as per the numbers. If I recall, we were 2/10 of a PSI.
You went
different.
Pressure equalization valve to open, and where it says go down to 4, we went to 3.8.
Okay.
That's what it stabilized out at.
Right.
And then the repress O2 only brought it back up to 4.4, and that gave us a delta P of near 0. So there wasn't any cycling back and forth, it was just one cycle open, and that's as far as it went.
Well, all that cycling back and forth, that only applies, I think, if you have a problem where you don't have the full volume of the limb. Okay. Configuring for limb ejection, docking probe, and venting and latches, umbilical power, and temperature. All right, the only funny here was that when I opened up the hatch to get into the tunnel, there was a peculiar odor in the tunnel. An odor which is, in my mind, similar, not quite exactly the same as burned electrical insulation, but definitely some sort of a burnt smell up in the tunnel.
You commented that the wiring and the cables seem to have retained this odor.
Well, I think this is just normal. Any fabric will retain odor where metal will not, but I don't think it
meant. Well, I've noticed that same odor as characteristic as some of this new material that we have. A lot of the bags, if you get them right close to you, have this same burned insulation odor to them. And I'm not sure that that's the whole thing, but that might explain.
Well, I don't know. My first impression was that something was burning or had been burnt up inside that tunnel, and I minutely went over every inch of wiring and all the connectors and got a flashlight and looked at everything, and everything looked absolutely pristine, normal, and we chose not to discuss it with the ground because, it hadn't popped any circuit breakers and everything appeared normal, and it seemed like maybe evidence of a past problem rather than an existing one. Maybe that wasn't it.
Well, I think it'd be a good idea for follow-on flights to sniff around and smell what these probe umbilicals smell like before.
They don't smell anything like that now.
Doesn't smell some of the bags or just see if they can find anything.
This was strong. I mean, this was enough to knock you down. When you opened that tunnel, it was
really
just
was.
One strong odor.
Well, this stuff's been exposed to the vacuum.
Well, I've been exposed to the boost environment too, and I'm not sure, I don't know how stuff gets in under there when the BPC is on, and the BPC doesn't leave until you're darn near in a vacuum, but despite that, I thought that perhaps there was some odor associated with the high temperatures of boost that somehow had gotten through the BPC and through that little tunnel vent line into the tunnel area. But it sure smelled, and although it's getting out of sequence here, it smelled now, and a couple of days later when we got back into the tunnel again in lunar orbit, or not lunar orbit, but coming up on LOI, when you went in to activate the LEM and pot around in there, the odor was back just as strong.
Another thing that I found was smoke coming up by the window on the engine.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, LEM ejection docking probe venting latches. All the latches made, latch number 6, which is one that had acted up a little bit down at the Cape during its tests, was the only one that it said its little recessed spring or whatever you call it said that it only needed one actuation to cock rather than two. This is normal, but other than 6, all of the others required said that you could feel that they were going to require two pulls to cock, and later they did. So all that hardware worked very well. Okay, extraction with the spring. We followed the checklist. Now, as a matter of interest on that, we separated, or we extracted in CMC free, and then went to DAP control and fired the aft thrusters for 3 seconds. And we went to CMC control, the DAP control, 5 seconds after spring actuation. Now, somewhere along the line, Neil and I both read a memo put out by MPAD saying that recontact analysis shows that for some failure modes, you weren't supposed to do that. You're supposed to use SCS control. And we spent, Ken Mattingly and I spent a lot of time the last couple of days before the flight trying to check all that down, and turned out to be sort of a witch hunt. But for future flights, I'd say they might look a little bit into, well, what is the best control mode for extracting the LEM? I think it's okay the way we did it, but for some failure modes, there may be if one of the springs get hung up and throws you sideways, it may be better to be doing that maneuver under SCS control rather than CMC free. And then went on. Photography, that's good.
No comments. Took pictures.
Vehicle dynamics of CSM and LEM during ejection from S4B. They're There were no abnormal dynamics. The thing backed out absolutely symmetrically, as nearly as I could tell. Adequacy of attitude control and stability. S4B was always very stable prior to, during, and after limb separation. SMRCS plumes, they had absolutely no effect on visibility or on S4B stability. S4B separation of performance, I'm not sure what that means. Anyway, nothing worth commenting on there. Evasive maneuver was a comfortable timeline. We thought at one time we might be somewhat rushed during this time period, but turned out it was comfortable and we were prepared to do the evasive maneuver. We could have done it, Neil, 5-10 minutes earlier than it was called out. And luckily, it is not a maneuver that is time critical. If it slips in time, 20 minutes or so, it doesn't really matter. So I think the way the present scheme of causing the S4B to overburn by 2 meters per second and then intentionally burning the SPS for 3 seconds to compensate for that overburn, that procedure appears to be a sound one, and I'd recommend no changes to it. S-band performance.
Fine. Let's see. Have we completed the evasive burn?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did notice the oxidizer unbalance start out because it was bouncing around, but I have a note down here on the evasive maneuver that it changed from minus 180 to 130 decrease. It was only a 3 second burn, but you could see that the thing was in the decreased position all the time, which is what we would expect. We just left it alone during that short burn. And we got the first gimbal motor off a little bit before I was able to confirm it, so we had to go through a little rain dance of turning it back on and then back off again. And that took a little extra time and used up a little extra amp hours out of the batteries, but the ground did confirm it, and we finally confirmed that we did get that gimbal motor off.
Okay, the S4B slingshot maneuver now. We never saw that.
No.
Seems like the attitude they gave us,
we didn't have the S4B in sight,
was not correct.
It was quite a while before we picked up the S4B, and it was rolling with a little bit of oscillation, but a little coning effect, but it definitely had a good roll to it. It was moving away. And this was during the non-propulsive part of the vent. And you could see two streams coming out on either side as the, I guess it's the oxidizer, was being vented out 180 opposite each other with the two cones going out. I guess the cone was maybe 30 degrees out one side and 30 degrees out the other. But it was definitely observable.
But something appeared to be wrong with the attitude they gave us. I don't know whether they miscalculated or what, but they gave us an attitude to see the slingshot out the, was it not the hatch window? Remember we asked them about that? I think it was the hatch window. And it wasn't, anyway, whatever window it was, we confirmed that we were looking through the correct window, and it wasn't there. S4B venting operation, I don't know what to say about that. I guess that went normally. Propellant dump during slingshot, we didn't see
slingshot.
We didn't
make use of that procedure, though, keeping, we didn't use it to any advantage of having the other state vector keep track of the S4B, which sounds Mickey Mouse, but it could have been some assistance in telling us where the guy was.
Yes, but we didn't use it.
A range rate and a verb 89, I don't know whether it's of any value.
other guys can consider it anyway.
Well, I think that that thing of watching the S4B is just sort of dealer's choice anyway. No real need to watch the S4B. It's just that if you're going to go to all the trouble of getting the ground to compute three angles through which you should be able to see it out a certain window, then you ought to compute the correct angles. That's all. EDS deactivation, nothing to say about that. Final CVS thrust level, what's that? Constant vent system. Thrust level, I don't know what to say about that. S4B closeout, don't know what to say about that. Dosimeter, radiation meters, workload, and timelines. In general, we got very little radiation, and of course we're going through the belts about this time, and I don't recall that we looked at the radiation survey meter. Did we do that? Did anybody look at that? I don't believe
no,
that was called out.
Wasn't called out.
And the dosimeter, we just gave them a once a day reading on that dosimeter, which before you go. Just in general, I thought all these, this comment workload and timelines, I thought the workloads and timelines were quite reasonable and had been well worked out by previous crews, and I'd recommend no changes to them. I thought that whole first 3 or 4 hours worth of activity was well thought out, and we were never rushed and we were never behind.
Well, our positioning of different people in different seats was a little unique, so it'd be a little different, I think, for other flights.
Yeah, well, our seat position is a separate subject in itself, but as far as being hurried, we were not. All of the first 4 or 5 hours of the flight, I thought, were quite reasonable. And that's all I have to say. This dosimeter, I'm not sure what it means. We did not give a dosimeter reading at this time. We gave daily dosimeter readings, which, as far as I'm concerned, fall into sort of the gee whiz category. It's just information of very little value to anybody. There are other sources for it, and I suppose it goes on somebody's graph somewhere for posterity. Other than that, I don't have anything to say about it. This thing won't turn off.